Very good. So, welcome back to the Beit Midrash here. Masechet Tanit, and glad to be with you tonight to resume our study in Tanit. And we were just saying that we're going to look at a more thematic way of some of the texts tonight on pages 7 and 8 of the Masechet. And this is about Inyan that Barry Yud brought up a couple of weeks ago. And that is, it's curious, it's somewhat surprising, that when we're talking about God's power and the rains, and the day of rain is more incredible than the day of the giving of the Torah, that internally here there's some development of rabbinic culture and a critique of rabbinic culture, that things can get, and this is where I'll use the metaphors that had come up on the first couple of pages, things can get really stormy. That there seems to be a real fear of, you know, dreaded storms, rain clouds, dangerous weather among the sages. Real dangerous weather. Lightning can strike. Okay? And we're going to see within some of the texts that exist some awareness. Again, we're going to hearken back to this awareness of what we've already seen in terms of the sages treating each other with some ill will, or the sages creating tension because of their disagreeing and disagreements, and where that really can lead. And I'm going to explore this with you, not only from the Tani texts that are going to be in our focus in terms of the study on the pages of Tani, but then how that's kind of intertextually related to a story in Bava Metzia. So the word intertextual was and is really a defined term in Jewish studies, mostly through the great work, if you want to have one scholarly locus of it, through Daniel Boyarin's work, Midrash and Intertextuality. Intertextuality can sometimes be as easy and as clean and as simple as, I see the root used over here in this story, and I see the root in Hebrew used over there in that story, and obviously the texts, they interrelate, right? But another time, a character in a story can be the reason why we go find one other story about that character, and we say, this is really an intertext. This is really a related text. So it's basically the term could be related, but it's intertextual. And that you can't really get the full import of one story over here unless you consider all of the narrative that's going on over here. Right? So I want to do a little intertextual work with what will be a very interesting story in and of itself that really is about the storm that rages among the sages that is introduced in Tani but not fleshed out entirely. So we need this Bava Metzia source that we're going to turn to in order to really see that storm rage and what it can lead to. And then we're going to go back to a later piece in Tani from a page that we haven't gotten to yet and wrap up with a piece that's down the line a little bit in Tani that we're yet, you know, even touching with where we're holding in the Gemara, okay? So I want to start with a small piece on Tanit 7a. And actually what I did is tonight I created a source sheet that's going to come around. So if you want to find this spot in your Gemaras, you can. But take one of these. This is on my Safaria site. And you see that it says Chevruta, Violence and Death as a title for the source sheets. Yeah, take one of your own. And it also says on the nature of the sages, and that's kind of a pun on purpose, or a double entendre, the nature of the sages, to suggest that some of it's in Tani because of the raging, potential raging storms and the deadly storms. The other piece is, the other possible title I was thinking of is, you know, a storm rages in the Beit Midrash, right? Just to put like an article, a thought out there that this could be an article about Heroes Tani begins with the powers of rain and the storms are discussed and there's a different kind of storm going on, and it's the storm, it's the rage of the sages that we have to be concerned concerned about and what that rain will ultimately beget. And so Amar Rabbi Chama Chanina, the Rabbi Chama son of Rabbi Chanina says, "My dichtiv, what's the meaning of that which is written?" Back to a little piece, I think we saw this already, but I want to bring you back to it. Barzel be barzel, yachad. That iron sharpens iron, yached. In other words, that it sharpens iron. And the full verse in Mishle, in Proverbs, let me just call it up here. Barzel is found 88 times in 80 verses in the Tanakh, by the way.
The word iron?
Yeah. So Mishle, so iron sharpens iron, barzel barzel yachad, the ish yachad penei re'ehu. Iron sharpens iron, right? And this is the part that we don't have quoted. The ish yachad penei re'ehu. A man sharpens another man. A friend sharpens another friend. So, yachad penei re'ehu, Rashi says, talmidei chachamim mechadadin ze leze b'halacha. He's actually quoting our Gemara, Rashi, and telling you that what it's referring to when it says a person sharpens a person or a friend sharpens a friend is that it's a reference to the sages sharpening the sages. So that's how it's interpreted right here in Tani, this first passage. Lomar lecha ma barzel ze chad mechaded et chavero af shnei talmidei chachamim, two sages mechadedin ze et ze b'halacha. They sharpen each other. Now, that's a kind of intellectual use of the word sharpen, right? But as we read the passage, we can't get away from the fact that if you think about this iron that's being discussed and what it sounds like to be in a blacksmith shop, right? And the kind of inherent pounding and somewhat, you know, in a smaller sense, violence to the metal that's being done to shape it, to get it into shape, you know, the heat and the glowing, there it is, glowing, right? Have we all been to a blacksmith shop or seen a recreation of a blacksmith shop? You know, that's grounded for us, right? So there's a certain level of real work on that through the, you know, the anvil and the hammer and the heating. And so just that alone implies that there's a little battle making going on here, or shaping. As we know, wrought iron can be shaped into beautiful kinds of, wondrous kinds of fences and gates and whatever iron is used for, to really create beautiful sculpture and statue, and it can be for all kinds of purposes, and especially iron tools, for all they brought us forth, the nourishment we enjoyed with the hearth tools that iron was used for, to keep a horse healthy, and the irons of the horseshoes. You know, so it's not only that iron brings me to this level of feeling like there's a dimension of violence in the system, and that they're sharpening one another like that. But the notion that sharpen is used implies to me that at least it's a sharpening of some kind of piece of that iron, and there's real work at sharpening that piece of iron. And I hear it, you know, clang, 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 to get that into its shape. That doesn't say too much, you know, the valence here is not yet either negative. Actually, it's probably positive, yeah. If I was to say negative versus positive, that we're looking to sharpen one another, and we're looking to help the fire, the glow of Torah that was in the heart, that is still in the metal, become shaped into a usable tool that can help us navigate the realities of life, our world, etc. But on the other hand, there's still some notion here that in the Iron Age, we understand that iron could have been used for battlements and weapons and all that that implies as well.
And ask you, what is the original iron sharpens iron? What context is that originally?
You were getting it from the Proverbs.
It's been Mishlei.
Yeah, it's in the Book of Proverbs.
So it's just separate. It's just alone. It's just like
It's wisdom literature. So yeah. it's an aphorism. Okay. The verse before it, if that makes a difference. Sometimes they say, look at the verse before, look at the verse after a verse from Proverbs. So I'll give you just a little context. Whoever hides her hides the wind, like the ointment of his right hand, which betrays itself. In other words, he who thinks to watch her from lewdness guards the wind, just as it is impossible to guard the wind, so she will not be guarded. There's a sense of here, you have to go back to one verse. A continual dripping in a very rainy day and a quarrelsome woman are alike.
Okay.
So dripping in rain and quarrelsome women rain that drips from the roof into the house and drives out the inhabitants of the house, and they're kind of likening that to a quarrelsome woman in terms of a relationship.
Uh-huh.
And whoever hides her hides the wind, like the ointment of his right hand, which betrays itself. So, Rashi says, he who thinks to watch her from her lewdness guards the wind, just as it is impossible to guard the wind, so she will not be guarded. Do you understand what this is saying?
No.
Because I don't.
I get it.
I'm going to say...
I think it's a peeping Tom in there.
Yeah, it sounds like it, right?
I'm saying it's hard to guard her from her behavior.
Yeah, it's hard to stop her.
Yeah.
He calls Tzara'at to come upon him until he drives her out like a Metzora, who is purified with oil on the thumb of his right hand. In other words, it just needs to be some purification about getting it. But then it says iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens another. And so, you know, it doesn't seem to build.
But there's no connection.
Whoever guards the fig tree shall eat its fruit, so he who waits on his master shall be honored. Okay, so that's the one afterwards. But these are wisdom traditions that sometimes do make narrative sense and sometimes do not make narrative sense in the Book of Mishlei.
I must say, I didn't have so much the pounding iron. I had the vision of having a tool
sharpening.
Sharpened.
Yeah, like a sharpened.
Like knives,
right,
or like in the butcher shop.
Right. That's the image that came to my mind.
Uh-huh, so you had like the grinding wheel.
Right.
Yeah, it's sort of like a grinding, exactly.
Or other
implements that people use to sharpen.
Like when you take two swords and you... that's the way you sharpen
that two knives instead of having a sharpening steel.
Right.
Yeah, I guess I felt a little differently.
Well, I mean,
but I don't see that as being outside of the purview.
Yeah, no, I think it's,
no, it's
I think
a different image.
I think
the reason I have the same theory is that how does one make the other better? Okay, which is really, I think, where they're driving at.
Right.
Of the scholarship. Same thing. You have two pieces of iron. How can one make the other sharper? They're just the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the, at least, you know, my drive is that.
Mm.
It's interesting. While I was grabbing a bite before coming over, I read a column in the New York Times today about the Amazon deal. Mm-hmm. And the point of this is somebody who studied the number of patents that come from different locations. And he talked about the thing that people didn't appreciate is the loss of what he calls, I think, agglomeration. That when you have a concentrated group of highly skilled technical people, they actually do sharpen each other.
Mm.
And that's why other companies want to locate near those areas, because they know...
Yeah, they want to have the well of knowledge coming close to them.
Right, but it sounded like you could make the same sort of sharpening.
The competition between them.
Yeah, competition and cooperation, you know, a mixture of those. But that is why we have, and we increasingly have this concentration, because that's where the best ideas actually come from, and you have more and more concentration of the locations of where patents are applied from.
Well, I think it's true in a number of other disciplines as well. I mean, in legal practice, when you have a complicated legal question, you get several knowledgeable people in the room, and you know, people kind of create based on each other's feedback. But also, this reminds me, we do this today with iron. You know, when you if you buy a set of knives, there's always one of those little, you know, things on it.
The round rods to do.
Because there are actually these microscopic imperfections in the blade that you're just smoothing and bringing into alignment so that the knife works better.
Okay. So I can appreciate the fact that this text on its own could really be about the convening of sages and the way that they will help one another to make the better halachic arguments, the more innovative chidushim, the new sense of what needs to be established, the new understandings that could come, the solidification of the understanding once one has the ability to get rid of the microscopic misunderstandings, and allow your metaphor to carry it out. So I admit that fully, and I admit that I'm influenced by a text in Kiddushin that I think I've mentioned before, and that is the one that says when sages start in the Beit Midrash, they come in like fierce warriors, and they end like lovers at the gates, right? And so that sage with his or her, with his understanding really, comes with a certain kind of readiness and passion and ready to do battle, and that text intertextually does not have to be one that informs our read of this passage, which could be read more like the Amazon deal of the past and to bring people into Silicon Valley to create the Wadi in Israel, the valley of those who think and are in this, or the firm that collects the best and the brightest in order to create new understandings and new approaches for the defense, right? So that's definitely here. And so the next text really will make your point in a very clear way. It's both on the source sheet, it's from 7a, it's on 7a2 on the right hand side if you're following along in the Gemara. And Amar Rabba Bar Chana says, Lamanim Shalu Divrei Torah Ke'esh, why are the words of Torah compared to fire? Right? And in this vein, though, so if I think about it in terms of the notion of the iron, well, the words of Torah become that hearth, right? Become the fire. And so in order to even get my iron instrument into a place of real, I could shape it and I can work with it to really develop it into the tool I need, I could see the words of Torah just simply reading to hear. By the way, it's going to get into a different issue of individuals versus working in a group or working within a dyad for learning. But I could see, oh yes, imagine that now. The words of Torah themselves are lighting this up, lighting these iron implements on fire so that they can be shaped and formed and reformed and reimagined and understood in a different way. And again, I like that very much, that the words of Torah themselves are the fires you need to create the tools for the world that we're looking to engage. But then to keep going, why are the words of Torah compared to fire? As it said, Halo chol divari ka'esh ne'um Hashem. Is my word not like fire? God says, my word is like fire. Lomar lecha, this is to teach you, ma esh eino dolech yechidi, just as fire does not ignite from a single piece of wood. Right? I can't make a whole fire if I only have one single piece of wood. I can't really create the fire I need. Right? I can have one piece of wood on fire, but I can't create a fire. So too, the words of Torah are not retained by someone who's studying on his own. If you're going to isolate yourself, you'll never sharpen your mind. You'll never come up with the understandings that you could if you join yourself to the group who studies together. V'hainu de'amar Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina, and this is in essence what Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina said, my dichtiv, what's the meaning of that which is written, cherev el habadim v'no'alu, a sword upon those who are alone, and they shall become fools. Cherev al sonehen shel tamidei chachamim. That's interpreted as sword upon the enemies of such Torah scholars. And if you look down below, the euphemism refers to what? Scholars themselves, as is common in the writings of the sages. They do not refer directly to Israel, Torah scholars, and the like, with a statement that implies punishment, but refer to the enemies of Israel. In other words, they call themselves enemies of Israel, those who are not fully cooperating within the culture and within the kind of halachic path that they see as being the right halachic path. She'oskin bad v'bevad b'torah, they engage in Torah study on their own without study partners. V'lo od ela shemetapshin, and not only that, but they become foolish. Tipesh. Stupidity reigns. So when they're only doing it alone, there's nobody to correct their reading. There's nobody to suggest that, no, it relates this way. No, you're seeing quite the opposite because you didn't read that lo ela. There's lots of times the turns of phrases within texts themselves need that kind of the way that we say things out loud in the Beit Midrash. No, let me tell you how I read it. Oh, yes, I see how you're reading it. It's a whole different, it's quite the opposite. You can go from one extreme to the other in a second with the Chevruta, because the Chevruta is the one who's helping you fix your misunderstanding. And to be able, by the way, in this kind of generous way, to admit that you're not really understanding something, unless you're in Chevruta and read it and discuss it and work through it, and the other person is there to help you fine-tune that, to get rid of not only what's microscopic, but literally what's blatantly a nick in the knife. We have to really rely on that, even among, quote-unquote, the initiated. We're talking about the initiated. We're talking about people whom we trust to know the sources behind this necessary understanding of one verse or another, or the law in a certain case, given a certain case. We trust that they know, but no, it's saying if you sit there and you try to either adjudicate the matter alone or understand it alone, you bring to the world tipush, tipesh. That's to become really a fool. V'lo od ela shechot'in. And not only that, but you, on top of that, bring sin to the world. Sin of your own, sin of others, potentially. Ketiv ha'acha v'no'alu. For here it's written concerning those who study alone, and they shall become fools. U'ketiv ha'atam. And elsewhere it's written, asher no'alnu v'asher chatanu, that we have acted foolishly and that we have sinned, in Numbers. So we see that the verb no'alu or no'alnu is used synonymously with what? With sin, because of that other verse that mentions the foolishness and the sinning all at once. Right? I can learn that if it's used in one place and doesn't have the word sin by it, but it's used in another place, the verb, and I also have sin connected to it, that over there it suggests that they became foolish and sinned, just like it became over here that they became foolish and sinned. The Ebit Eime Mehacha, but I have another place you could learn it from. No'alu Sareit Tzoan. The officers of Tzoan have become fools. Hit Uet Mitzrayim. They have led Egypt astray. And since going astray is synonymous with sinning, this verse too is associated with sin. So I bring you the places that the verses use the verb to become foolish, and I show you that each of them has their own way of expressing the absolute sin or waywardness that we absolutely want to avoid. And as soon as the word sin is mentioned, right, this is obviously something that we chatanu, bagadnu, right? We know that that's not the right path in terms of the Beit Midrash culture we're trying to establish. So it would be foolish to be alone.
So is this why you study Talmud in pairs?
This is exactly it. And what you see in the word above, Chevruta, to recognize that there is a text that will say explicitly, and I'll just say it outside for a minute, that the concept that we work with is im eino chevruta, if he doesn't have chevruta, doesn't have friends, he doesn't have colleagues, you have what then? Mituta. The opposite of friendship and the opposite of study in a dyad or among a group of sages or work with colleagues is simply death. And what I'm going to suggest is that in terms of answering what violence is inherent in the system, right? Anybody know that reference to the Monty Python? Come and see the violence inherent in the system. Help, help, I'm being repressed. This is after King Arthur makes his first stop and is on his journey onward to find the golden...
The chalice.
Yeah, exactly. The
Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail. And he comes to this old woman working in the field, and they have an autonomous, semi-autonomous collective at this castle instead of having a king with a defined system of royalty. And, you know, he walks up to this worker in the field and he says, "Man," and she says, "Woman." And immediately the dialogue starts, and the king ultimately, "I am your king." "Well, we don't have a king," she says. And the king ultimately winds up grabbing her on the shoulder, and she says, "Come and see the violent inherent in the system. Help, help, I'm being repressed." Worth watching. That scene in and of itself. Monty Python, Holy Grail, "Help, help, I'm being repressed." But I think what's going on here internally, again, there's violence inherent in the system, not just death as in I don't have friends and I don't have colleagues, but also that can be caused by potential storms of the sages themselves, and that gets into the note that, wow, they could really see themselves as really misbehaving, as really being a bore of a human being, a bore of a colleague, and that's why I again linked it to this other text that we'll get to in a few minutes. So, A, we established that you can sharpen one another in a positive way. B, that there's potential clashing sound going on. 2, Tanit 7a, that if you stay alone, though, you wind up becoming foolish. So you know you need one another. And so we know we need a culture of both agreement and refinement. Notice I didn't say disagreement entirely. Agreement and refinement, which is why I really love your notion of the grinding wheel and the rod that takes care of microscopic...
Sharpening stone.
I really like that, right? That is the refinement. That is the sharpening that we hope for. And yet, on Tanit 8a, and now if you turn to 8a, which is the next piece on the source sheet, and I'll find it for us again inside here. It's just a very short piece. It's on 8a2 in our Gemara on the left-hand column. It's towards the top. It's underneath another exposition of this last verse. Rava Amar. Rava Amar, Shnei Talmidei Chachamim Shiyoshvin Be'ir Achat, if two Torah scholars reside in one city, Ve'ein Nochin Ze Leze B'Halacha, and they are entirely at odds with one another. Ve'ein nochin. They don't give in at all. Okay? They don't try...
Not courteous with one another.
That one says not courteous, right. My source sheet says they're not courteous.
Not agreeable in the book.
And then not agreeable in the art scroll. So it goes from everything from not agreeable to not courteous to they're completely uncomfortable with each other.
No, here they say that they are studying benachat, means that they are not argumental.
They are not arguments?
Right, so the interesting piece is...
Here they say that they are studying, it's too mellow, it's too quiet.
Yeah.
So it's not good enough.
So isn't
it
interesting?
They need to be argumental. They need to fight each other.
Isn't it interesting that Hebrew to Hebrew art scroll doesn't really reflect this English translation that this art scroll offers, or the one that the Sepharia source sheet has on it, which I read over to check out if I like I wrote and agree with Curtius, because Curtius to me, in the full sense of the term, by way of a sage, means that I provide you with your space as a courtesy to have your understanding, and you provide me with my space to have my understanding. But in the Hebrew to Hebrew, which I also have upstairs, I was a little surprised to see that they really make it sound like that they want it to be more Beit Midrash like.
Yeah, they want to
shake it up.
Right, they want to have life.
But I think it's more about being disagreeable, and they're really not agreeable. Mitkanin ba'af malinoto. They provoke divine anger. Either which translation you're going to use, they provoke divine anger. Mitkanin ba'af. Af is the word in the Gemara that will be used for anger, right?
Or even when in the Bible,
it's because of the biblical Hebrew, right. But af itself can be really anger. It doesn't have to be ka'as. Umalinoto. And they stir him up. They stir God up. Shenemar, as it said, mikne af al ole. And here's that af word used as anger. He provokes anger which goes up and rises. So you have a real sense now that the Chachamim who live in one city and somehow they're not able to get along, whether or not that's completely being disagreeable about each other's halachic outlooks.
Yeah, but that should be good.
Or
Shammai, I mean.
Or they dislike each other so much that when I see you, I can't even be engaged with you because the culture here is not working because we're standing on ceremony about this that happened in the past. I'm now making things up. I don't know exactly what the case was. But somehow it doesn't work that we have this sharpening culture, right? So let's go either direction. It really provokes divine wrath, divine anger, us. Right? And that's a real harsh kind of sense of what you're provoking. What are you going to say, Judy?
If I think about it, I can sort of rationalize these two very different sounding translations as all having to do with not being able to engage in productive discussion.
Yes, on both sides. That's why the spectrum works both sides.
It kind of doesn't matter why.
Right. Whether or not you have chemistry and rapport, and you lack any of it, and you can't create the Beit Midrash culture that you need, or we completely disagree, I don't let you for a minute get away with your interpretation, and I get the whole world against you, and I stir things up, either which way, it provokes divine wrath.
You know, there is an old sentence that says that God will help me with my friends. With my enemies, I can manage alone.
Anger
is acquired by one who raises his pride.
So there you see... No, that's what the verse says. So the reason why the translation works that I don't give you an inch and I think I'm the right interpreter is because of the way the verse reads itself, right?
They say this. I mean, it's quite different because this one says they arouse anger upon the world. Here, it's much more personal. They provoke divine anger and bring it upon themselves.
Right, which is why I brought this. Good that you noticed that. So this is a different version of the Gemara that was put out by JPS. Not every tractate got a small JPS volume like this, but Tani did. And when it came to this passage, right, good you noticed that. scholars living in the same city are unpleasant toward one another because of differences in their interpretations of the law. They solicit wrath and bring it upon themselves. So this didn't go with the world. As it is said, the cattle also concerning the storm that cometh up. 124. Rabba explains mikne, cattle, as hit kaneba, to which the meaning of hit gareba, to provoke, is given. Af is again given as a noun, which is this wrath, and al ole, that cometh up, is paraphrased by the ma'alino to alehem. And the total then is they provoke wrath and bring it upon themselves. For there are different readings and interpretations. So, interesting little note here in Henry Malter's critically edited edition with translation. Very interesting tool that I picked up as I was preparing. So turn the page now, and you see that I included what we're going to continue in terms of Reish Lakish's piece. And that is Reish Lakish on 8A2 on the left-hand side, or on the source sheet, says, Amar Reish Lakish, my deity, what is the meaning of that which is written, Im yishoch hanachash below lachash, if a snake bites because it was not charmed? The ein yitro neval halashon, then the master of speech has no advantage. So if you think about what Reish Lakish is saying, Reish Lakish says, what is the meaning of the verse, if the serpent bite before it is charmed, then the charmer hath no advantage? In the time to come, all beasts will gather together and approach the serpent, saying to him, a lion attacks with his paws and eats his prey. A wolf tears and eats. But what pleasure have you in biting and killing? The serpent will reply, the charmer hath no advantage. The Hebrew for charmer is Baal HaLashon, which means what?
The owner of the tongue.
The master of the tongue. And here, figuratively, it's the slanderer. The serpent's reply thus is that neither has the slanderer any advantage, and yet he slanders. So only a tongue to slander with. And you have no real advantage. The lion has teeth. The wolf can tear you apart. They're going to get their prey. And what's the implication? That sages will slander other sages. And so that also is creating the anger in the world. And we have to understand that what we're getting here is a picture of what could be wrong in this culture we're creating. People can dissociate themselves from studying in the way and in refining the way we need them to refine the law. They can slander one another, be so lo banachat, whatever that means. Again, challenge each other publicly, discourteous to each other, that this really creates divine wrath. And we know that divine wrath is the equal is the opposite of rain in its season to produce the kind of nourishment and wetness of the world, the rachness that we need for things to work out in the right way.
So it extrapolates to political polarization.
It does.
Maybe it starts from political polarization.
I think in a very deep way, it is not only political polarization that I think it points to if we're going to really make the analogical jumps here, but there'll be another one where there'll be immature politicians or aggrandizing politicians really standing on ceremony or being offended by others, and then doing things that are wrathful. So wait until you hear that story.
Yeah, there's another thing here. We basically talk about lions and people. They attack things and they eat them.
Right.
Okay. When a snake bites, you know, clearly it doesn't. So you really have Now, if I steal something, I take the money, and I buy something to eat, okay, that's one type of crime or whatever else. But, you know, Lashon Hara,
right,
use that. It's a whole different category. It doesn't create any monetary difference or anything else. It doesn't affect anyone's standard of living. But in some ways here, it's more dangerous.
Okay, yes.
There's another line on that same theme.
It's not, Lashon Hara is not reversible. It's like a death penalty.
Right.
It's almost like the venom. If a snake does have fangs, and you do get what's considered to be a snake bite, right?
Yeah.
It's not that the bite kills you. It's that the venom will ultimately get you if it's a poisonous snake. Then what you're saying is that the slander is the venom. But if it's not a snake that bites, and it's only a snake that has a tongue that scared your daylights out of you, then that too is
are there poisonous snakes in the Middle East?
Of course.
Oh,
poisonous?
Yeah.
Poisonous? Okay.
Definitely.
The only snakes in the Middle East that is not poisonous, it's what we call the black snakes.
Uh-huh.
And as a matter of fact, we want to keep them alive. Because they eat all the mice and all the other stuff
yeah.
In the field. So when you are in a kibbutz and you see a black snake, don't kill him. Leave him. They are territorial. And if there is a black snake in this territory, there will not be any other snake that can hurt you. So,
but I think it's emphasizing that these animals, this is their nature and what they need to do to survive. Humans don't have to slander each other to survive, which
right.
is the analog and setting the distinction between the animal world and the human.
Definitely. There's definitely a piece here about rising above that nature.
Yeah, there is the Altel Bin Plei Chavcha Berabim. It's very important in our tradition.
Yeah, don't embarrass anyone in public. Yeah.
I think this works very well as a metaphorical discussion, but it suggests to me that my understanding is actually that the reason that snakes bite isn't just to be a pain in the neck and ruin your life. They're biting because either poisonous snakes, that's how they paralyze their
yeah,
prey,
their
and
nature.
They do in fact eat
yeah.
pretty large
yeah.
creatures, and that when a relatively small snake is biting a person that they know they can't possibly eat, it's generally a defensive move.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it suggests that that's just not part of the picture here. Either they didn't know about that phenomenon or just they figured, let's not worry about it. It's a great metaphor.
I think it's a good
no,
metaphor.
But snake, you
no,
know
but I think they probably did know about it because defensiveness,
sure.
being on the defensive and being so offended, you know, there's another aspect of that defensive move as being so offended that
the
big thing is...
The negative aspect of defense as opposed
yeah.
to...
I think they know that dynamically.
As opposed to avoiding becoming a victim.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I guess I agree completely. So there are two reasons, offense and defense,
yep.
for in the animal kingdom. But I think if I were to try to wring it out a little bit, I'd say that humans have abilities to defend themselves without crossing the line into incivility.
Yeah, but you know, that's interesting. But there are people in our that want the dirt to come out
huh.
because it's giving them, I don't know how to call it, be a man, be a macho, or be whatever
yeah,
you want
no,
to call it. Otherwise, they cannot exist.
But that's
and
what
that's,
leads to an incivil,
exactly.
an incivil society.
Now,
yeah.
another thing about the snake is the story of the snake in Chava. That the snake, we understand that they are sneaky. They have their ways to manipulate. And Lashon Hara is exactly the same what the snake did to Chava. He manipulate, and we can, with our tongue, we can manipulate situation that will not be comfortable to the other.
I think you're 100% right. I think you can't read a story about a snake in our tradition without having the intertext of the snake in the Garden of Eden and figure out what really is going on there and how that's really playing out. There's many, many different ways to try to read the challenge of the snake as providing some of the first challenges towards wisdom building in the world, and do it positively. I actually gave a sermon one Rosh Hashanah about this, that Eve was challenged with the wisdom making in the world first, and having to interpret the extreme notion of the Nachash as the sage and the tradition, and she had to figure out what fence to build around it, and if only Adam had, you know, taken her example and asked more questions about just what she presented, that it could have been a whole wisdom tradition of Eve that was the beginning of Reishit Chochmah. It was the beginning of wisdom, and so that's taking it, though, from the, if you will, feminist read. In general, right, we would say that this snake, though, represents the Lashon Hara and the notion of Ra Minul Rav, that people did have the compulsion towards this evil or this kind of devilish way about them. And despite the fact that we're given this capacity to be civil, to structure and count our days, to arrange and put to good use the resources that are granted us, to decide whether or not it is just the vegetable world or also the animals will become part of that too. The workout of Parshat Bereshit and Parshat Noach could be, you know, looked at like that. That despite all that, we fall flat, often fall flat, fall short in terms of those expectations, and therefore the sages themselves who are trying to create this great culture of normative ethics and a read of Torah that helps us express God's will also fall flat and create all kinds of divine wrath, divine anger. It was that divine anger that led towards the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden. So the snake here fits right in. And the snake, who's a slanderer, at the same time that disagreeing or not being willing to even engage in study leads to divine wrath, also over here, slander itself and nastiness among sages with their tongues becomes part and parcel of the whole picture of what could go wrong and how people are so uncivil. And again, that's at the core of this culture if you're not careful, if you don't say words in their right times. At the end of the day, what I started to think about is, and I've never seen halakha about when to start saying prayers and what to say in terms of the words we should insert. I've never seen those as like a key or a reminder to open your mouth or keep it shut today at the right times. Right? Like insertions to prayers. Do I say this today? Do I not say this today? Like maybe the larger picture of why that's even part of the fabric of the prayer service is so it reminds us when to open our mouths and when not to open our mouths. Right? Interesting by way of the musr of that aspect, because that's where we started. I bring it back to there.
So we have three kind of areas that are potentially disastrous for Chachamim.
So far.
Yeah.
Tonight.
So is this also applied to those who are not studying and not scholarly, or is this really specific to the scholarly community, do you think?
I think that the Gemara, another time we said that many of the sins that are mentioned that create drought and famine
right.
are the top 10 list, if you will, right? The big ones that are out there that in our culture beget divine wrath, and therefore we pay for it through needing then to wonder, like, did we cause this drought? Did we cause this famine? So I think it's to everyone, the answer. On the other hand, the interesting observation was that this is very much about the rabbinic culture itself and the sages and how they interact and whether or not they are the ones bringing divine wrath down to the world. And so that was the question tonight in terms of just the sages' part in that.
Can you tell us more about the original statement in Ecclesiastes, which I find if a snake bites before it is charmed, then a charmer has no advantage, a fascinating statement in and of itself. So I was just wondering, what is the Ecclesiastes context surrounding that?
If I remember correctly,
yeah.
If someone's taken by the good life, and I haven't learned a way to navigate this world through any kind of moral framework, and it's almost like hedonism and pleasure and hevel hevelim, all that's there. I have no need to control or frame or limit because I've yet to be charmed by a systematic approach that can help me understand this is a holy experience of this reality and this existence that I'm to have, and I'm to do things in measures and balances, right? But if I just live a charmed life, but then something befalls me and it crushes me, whether that's an existential kind of being crushed or it's a health kind of challenge or it's the like, then I've learned nothing. The charmer has no advantage. God nor any other system of moral living doesn't really help guide and help me navigate that which is, quote unquote, what I thought was a charmed life, right? I struck out to go live life, but now I've fallen. I never really got the teachings that could help me put life in perspective. So that's the way I think that approach in Ecclesiastes plays itself out and where the verse comes in. Let's look specifically for a second, Barry.
Because I mean, I'm, you know, just project because I obviously don't have any real knowledge. But so, you know, the charmer thinks that he'll be okay.
The charmer has
because
had a
he's
chance
learned
to
how to charm. But if you come up against a snake,
a charmer always will.
That is of a particular nature. Your knowledge is going to not necessarily protect you. It's sort of
if you have a charmer,
okay, a wise man's heart.
Somebody with knowledge, I can tell you that.
A wise man's heart inclines him to his right side, but a fool's heart to his left. Right, immediately, like you know, gone the foolish way. And also on the road, when a fool walks by, his understanding fails him, and he says to everyone that he's a fool. If the spirit of the ruler rises against you, leave not your place, for deference pacifies great offenses. In other words, try to take some measure of discipline. There's an evil which I have seen under the sun and an error which proceeds from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses and prince walking as servants upon the earth. He who digs a pit shall fall into it, and whoever breaks a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. He who removes stones shall be hurt by them, and he who chops wood shall be endangered by that. If the iron is blunt and one does not whet the edge, he must apply more strength, but wisdom increases skill. So, you know, the life that's...
like humility
and wisdom can inform you. If the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage in a charmer. You know, you're just going about, you're not taught, you're the fool.
One last question. I'm picturing this group and their behavior and maybe being, you know, courteous or not, or working together. About how many would gather in the Talmud for discussion? How many do you think would be together?
It's a very good question. It's a very interesting question. The historiography of the Hebrew University tried to really recreate rabbinic culture within the writings of, you know, explorations of rabbinic history. Menachem Alon's Jews in Their Land has a whole chapter on the gatherings of sages,
right,
and what it looked like, and who was in the institution, and how many were in the institution, and what it looked like in the Beit Midrash, and was there a kala that was like a major convention, like we would consider a convention today, of all those who gather in sometimes it's in America and only the Americans come, but sometimes it's in America and it's international, and sometimes it's in Europe, and people converge from all corners of the earth. You know, these are the questions that they asked. It seems like there are institutions that are smaller, and there's a Beit Midrash, and there are sages and disciples. It seems like sometimes they're in the attics of people, in lofts, where you can see, you know, in the kind of structures of the ancient world, there's a very limited number, and they're there to clarify, and a few people who are lesser in
the
status.
The story of the cheder.
Yeah, there's stories of these smaller spaces,
are you thinking like
larger.
10 or 15 or 5?
It seems that, in other words, the answer is, it seems like there are different groups in different either spaces or institutions that we can point to. It, from the literature itself.
There are teachers that have followers.
So that you have sages and you have disciples and you have the disciples of the disciples, and how many generations are alive at once? It seems like, you know, you have, again, smaller institutions that become larger institutions, that become the major institutions, Pumbedita and Sura for the rabbis in Babylonia. Jerusalem is maybe not the core after Rabbi Yocham Bar Yochai. Runs away to the cave. Rabbi Yehuda is over here after Yochanan ben Zakkai leaves Jerusalem to save the sages of Yavne. How many were in that synod, if you will? Who knows exactly? But you have different groups. And then maybe the Kala, which is the big rabbinic gathering, you could have, and who knows? We don't have registration lists. We don't have those kinds of documents that say who were there, except a few in the Mishnah are mentioned in being in the attic as they're clarifying the disagreements of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, and it seems like some of the disciples were there too. You know.
In the Rav Kook time, they used to call it a kibbutz.
Right.
That they put together.
They put together all these meetings of folks. So. It wasn't like today, though, where you had these thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews who make up a Haredi community, and you see the sea of, you know, black hats and white shirts today.
I'm picturing much smaller.
Yeah,
but, you know, when they do the siyum in the stadium, you have like 100,000 people coming.
Today. So we won't retroject today's kind
years.
Of numbers and the ability to get there to yesteryear. Okay. So let's go back, though, in terms of what we were talking about groups. But now I want to get you into something that the Gemara says about a specific someone who's quite a well-known sage, a named sage, Rabbi Yochanan. And it's going to be a story from Tani 9a. So we can say we got to page 9 today. And we're going to see a story here about Rabbi Yochanan. What's going to be interesting for us to note is who else appears in this story. Again, it's as a refinement of rabbinic character about who they should listen to and who sometimes they just blow off. Mm-hmm. It's going to be about what a woman knows about this character of Rabbi Yochanan that leads her to say what she says. So they obviously know the back story of this guy. You know, they know from reputation what happened, right? There's a known measure of this sage might be a very well-respected sage with a lot to teach about Torah understandings. There's also what to worry about when we see that he's engaging this child. So there's a child in this story. There's a woman in this story who's the mother of the child. And there is the famous Rabbi Yochanan. So, in Tani 9a, it's on page 9a1 on the right-hand side if you're in the actual Sefer. It's on the page here if you want to go from the page. I'm going to go from the page because I looked through this translation, and I'm going to use this translation on my source sheet. But take a look at where it's different, if it's different in the art scroll, if some of you are going to stay in the art scroll. Okay, so the Gemara is going to relate another story about the preciousness of this certain child who did come up before as being quite well Torah informed.
Like a prodigy?
Yeah. Well, it's the son, what's important is that it's the son of Reish Lakish.
Okay.
And as soon as you say he's the son of Reish Lakish, and it's a story about Rabbi Yochanan, whom we've had stories about, remember? We heard a lot about his great teachings and what he knew and the three things that he taught about X, Y, Z. Oh, Reish Lakish, we know, is Rabbi Yochanan's chevruta. Also well known is that Reish Lakish is Rabbi Yochanan's brother-in-law.
I thought it was his father.
His brother-in-law.
Oh.
And Rabbi Yochanan's sister is married to Reish Lakish. So just keep that in mind. So, he says,
all in the family.
The two Ashkeche Rabbi Yochanan liyinuka de Reish Lakish. So he encountered the young son of Reish Lakish, the Yativ Amar. He was sitting and reciting the verse, Ivelet Adam Tisalef Darko. The foolishness of a man perverts his way. The foolishness of man perverts his way, and also the implication is that it brings him punishment. Va'al Hashem yizaf libo. And his heart frets against Hashem. The person, in other words, what? When someone sins and you have every manner of mishap that befalls him, he complains and wonders why these things are happening to him and ultimately blames God. So you're doing this to me, God. Yati Rabbi Yochanan v'ka mitame. Rabbi Yochanan sat and he was thinking. Amar, he asked, Mi kamidid chetive b'chetuve? Is there anything written in the writings, the lo remise b'raita, that is not alluded to in already the Torah? So what had gone on before? In citing a verse from Proverbs, the child has Rabbi Yochanan ask him, oh, but can you prove to me the same thing from a Torah verse?
Challenging.
He's challenging him. And so, Amar Lei, the boy says to Rabbi Yochanan, Atuhami lo remize. Is this verse not alluded to in the Pentateuch? V'ha'ketiv, in the Pentateuch it's written, V'yetze libam mazorasa. And they were afraid, saying to one another, Mazot asa Elohim lanu. What is this that God has done to us? Right? The brothers of Joseph blamed God for their misfortune. Instead of what? Taking responsibility. So they already hinted at. So this is the answer. And Dala Ene, Rabbi Yochanan lifts up his eyes. Now what do you think that means?
He was surprised.
Oh my goodness. What a little chacham. Right? He's sharper than I am. V'chazabe and looked at him. And he looked at him. And what is this v'chazabe? He gave him a look. Right? What are you? You're being a wise guy? You didn't tell, you know, you didn't start with the Torah? Maybe? Or, wow, who taught you such a thing? Or did you know that from who? I'm going to expand it a little bit, because that's why Reish Lakish's name is mentioned. It didn't just say his nephew was there. It didn't say his nephew came. It says the Yanuka shel Reish Lakish. It says the boy of Reish Lakish was there.
The baby.
Already your father is supposed to be my chevruta. What are you doing in that role? He's kind of like shocked a little bit that this could possibly be. And the boy's mother comes out. Atya ime apikte. The boy's mother came and took her son away. Apikte. Gets him right out of there. Right? Gets him right out of there. Amrale, she says to him, Tami kame. Get out of here. Go away from Rabbi Yochanan. Deloli yavad lach. He shouldn't do to you k'de'aved la'avuch as he did to your father. Now this is after the well-known story of what Rabbi Yochanan did to Reish Lakish. And that requires us to go to Bava Metzia 84a and to understand what did happen vis-a-vis this, what was once a famed chevruta and a beautiful story about Chachamim who lived in the same place, who became family, right? And use that as a metaphor for everything that becoming family is supposed to be about or could be about, right? The power of that union of hearts and minds and souls. And so look, I included Bava Metzia 84a on page, the bottom of page 2 on the source sheet. So what's the story? We're just going to read it outside. The Gemara relates, one day Rabbi Yochanan was bathing in the Jordan River. Now, right before this, in the Gemara, it talks about how beautiful Rabbi Yochanan is, physically.
Interesting.
Now, remember we had this discussion about the ugly vessels and the beautiful vessels? When we had a passage that said, how could the Caesar's daughter, the ruler's daughter of Rome, comes and says, how could there be such Torah learning in such an ugly vessel? Remember that? And the response was, well, how could he keep the wine in an earthen vessel? Shouldn't it be in beautiful gold and silver vessels? And then he transfers the wine into gold and silver, and what? It starts to taste like tin. And so the response at the end of that sugya was, though, but there are some very good-looking vessels. Who?
And it's very sloppy.
And it's Rabbi Yochanan.
Rabbi.
And it's Rabbi Yochanan. So all the while, we've had references to this Rabbi Yochanan, good-looking Rabbi Yochanan. And Reish Lakish sees him, and what? Jumps into the river, pursuing him. Now, at that time, Reish Lakish was the leader of a band of thieves. So the story goes that he was most likely jumping in. This is a very negative comment, that he was jumping in to potentially seduce and or rape this woman. But it's not a woman. It's Rabbi Yochanan.
Right.
Rabbi Yochanan, he thinks it's a woman because, the tradition says, Rabbi Yochanan has no beard. And he has long hair. So he's a little bit hippie looking, I guess.
Jesus.
You know, Jesus looking.
Good.
At least from our versions of Western iconography. Rabbi Yochanan turns to Reish Lakish. Now, why do they have him as a thief too? Why is he a thief? Because remember, there's also a little passage, I didn't put it on the source sheet, I should have, that what brings really anger, God's anger to the world as well? Gezel.
Thievery.
Gezel.
What's Gezel?
It's either thievery,
uh-huh,
or it's violence. Malter translates Gezel as violence in that case, as opposed to just robbery or theft. But Gezel really is Lizol.
Gezel, it's when somebody takes money from you and you know about right. it and you can still take the money.
Yeah, exactly.
From you.
It's beyond embezzlement, right?
It's like almost embezzlement.
It's beyond embezzlement. Anyway, Rabbi Yochanan says to Reish Lakish, and this is going to change his life forever, your strength is fit for Torah study. Reish Lakish says to him, your beauty is fit for women. Rabbi Yochanan says, if you return, in other words, make tshuva, to come to the world of Torah, you can take my sister for marriage. Now, there's two ways to look at that phrase, by the way. One, I have the power to, quote-unquote, arrange this marriage, whether or not it's his father that has that power at this point. We'll say that Rabbi Yochanan on the stage took that into his power. Or two, what he means to say is, become an upstanding citizen, learn Torah, and guaranteed you'll woo and connect and what's a good word for it? You'll entice my sister, and I'm sure the two of you will wind up married. Yeah. So maybe she likes the guys from the wild side, and there's none in the Beit Midrash, and he's going to bring home this, you know, once marauder. Backstory, he used to write bad checks, now he's going to become a sage.
Rabbi Akiva,
right? He's a dangerous guy. But even with Rabbi Akiva, he was a shepherd. He wasn't this dangerous
Reish Lakish.
Right.
He was.
So sometimes that story can be, you know, a very interesting romantic kind of reality, right? That you have this big tshuva. So he does that. Reish Lakish accepts upon himself to study the Torah. And subsequently, Reish Lakish wanted to jump back out of the river to bring back his clothes, but he was unable to return as he had lost the physical strength as soon as he accepted the responsibility to study Torah upon himself. It's not a matter of physical strength that Torah provides. It's a matter of spiritual strength that Torah provides. Rabbi Yochanan taught Reish Lakish Bible and taught him Mishnah and turned him into a great man. Eventually, Reish Lakish becomes one of the outstanding Torah scholars of the generation. Now, one day, the sages of the study hall were engaging in a dispute concerning the following braita. Now, what is that in and of itself? The kind of culture that we want, right? Except that it's in regard to the sword, the knife, the dagger, the spear, a hand sickle, a harvest sickle. From when are they susceptible to ritual impurity? In my opinion, again, telling list of items that they're arguing about. Because some of them are for battle, and some of them are for what could come of a nourishing Torah community, as opposed to a dangerous Torah community with weapons. The Braita answers. And by the way, I also am holding, I didn't put it on the source sheet, but I'm going to just point to the fact that there's a very famous story that a lot of people point to as even a paradigmatic story of how the conservative movement interprets Jewish law, and the argument begins about the ritual purity of a what? Of an oven. Mm. Right? You've heard this story, Tanur Shel Achnai.
Achnai.
And that the argument begins with two sages, and the argument is about the ritual purity and impurity of the oven of Achnai, just like the argument over here begins with the ritual impurity or purity of certain kelim, of certain useful tools for our lives, right? So there's some resonance in here for me about both of those stories, so hold that also as background or as intertextual linkage. So the Braita answers, though, it's from the time of completion of their manufacture. So when you manufacture the knife, the dagger, the spear, the hand sickle, the harvest sickle, when they're susceptible to ritual impurity, as soon as they're completed in terms of the manufacture, which is the halacha with regard to metal vessels in general, then they're going to be susceptible. The sages ask, though, and when is the completion exactly of their manufacture? Like, how do you define that point? Rabbi Yochanan says it's from when one fires these items in the furnace. Reish Lakish said it's from when one scours them in water after they've been fired in the furnace. Right? Rabbi Yochanan says to Reish Lakish, oh, a bandit knows his banditry. You're an expert in weaponry because you were a bandit in your youth, is how most understand
it. That's Lashon Hara now.
Yeah. Now he reminded him of that old place before he was a Baal Tshuva, right?
And it's in public.
And it's in public, and it's the snake's tongue.
Right.
Reish Lakish says to Rabbi Yochanan, what benefit did you provide me by bringing me close to the Torah? There among the bandits, they called me leader of the bandits. And here, too, they call me leader of the bandits. Right? Why? Because you just called me a bandit. Mm-hmm. Now that everybody's talking. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yochanan says to him, and he's so offended by the question that he's got to answer him. Right? What do you mean you're asking me what benefit I gave you? So you were the bandit leader back then. You don't understand what portion in the world I've given you by teaching you Torah, by teaching you Mishnah, by making you a great sage? He literally believes that Reish Lakish challenged him in public. as opposed to that nasty saying that Rabbi Yochanan laid on his brother-in-law. And he says, I provided benefit to you as I brought you close to God, under the wings of the Shekhinah, under the wings of the Divine Presence. As a result of the quarrel, and Rabbi Yochanan stood his ground, lo nochin ze baze, right? They were not courteous to one another. As a result of the quarrel, Rabbi Yochanan was offended, entirely offended, right? People get into that mode. I'm entirely offended by you now. Though you married my sister, though you're family now, though I taught you Bible, though I taught you Mishnah, though we've had this chavruta, and we've become stars of the Beit Midrash, totally offended, which in turn affected Reish Lakish. And this quickly in the Gemara, it turns to give you the narration. He fell ill. And Rabbi Yochanan's sister, who was Reish Lakish's wife, came crying to Rabbi Yochanan, begging that he pray for Reish Lakish's recovery. She says to him, do this for the sake of my children, so that they should have a father. He appeals to the deepest heartstrings. Rabbi Yochanan says to her the verse, leave your fatherless children, I will rear them. I will take care of them. She says to him, do so for the sake of my widowhood. Don't make me a widow. He says to her, the rest of the verse, and let your widows trust in me. Uses it like a what? What has he sharpened here? Not the agricultural implement, but the sword, the dagger. He has weapons. Ultimately, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish, he died. No intercession, he dies. The argument in the Beit Midrash, the slander that was the venom, completely creates illness, and what really turns it is his standing on being offended. Reish Lakish dies. Rabbi Yochanan was sorely pained now over losing him all. Oh, now he's sorely pained, right? And he realizes that the world, the fiery divine wrath has been delivered. The rabbis say, who will go calm Rabbi Yochanan's mind and comfort him over his loss? And they say, let Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat go, as his statements are sharp. Right? The sharp will sharpen the sharp. Not just in matters of halakha now. Now we're getting a suggestion that the sharp will comfort the afflicted. Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat went and sat before Rabbi Yochanan. With regard to every matter that Rabbi Yochanan would say, Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat would say to him, oh, there's a brisa that supports your opinion. And Rabbi Yochanan says, are you comparable to the son of Lakish? Are you like Reish Lakish, my chavruta? You're not sharpening me, and you're not comforting me. And in the discussions with the son of Lakish, when I would state a matter, he would raise 24 difficulties against me in an attempt to disprove my claim. And I would answer him with 24 answers. And the halakha by itself would become broadened and clarified. And yet you say to me, there's a ruling which is taught in a braita that supports your opinion? Do I not know that what I say is good? Being rebutted by Reish Lakish served a purpose. Your bringing proof to my statements doesn't serve any purpose. Rabbi Yochanan went around, rending his clothing, weeping and saying, where are you, Reish Lakish? Where are you, son of Lakish? Rabbi Yochanan screamed until his mind was taken from him. He went insane. And the rabbis prayed and requested for God to have mercy on him. And the mercy in this case was that God took his soul and Rabbi Yochanan died.
More like a Shakespearean tragedy.
That's right. And that tragedy is the storm. It's the storm. It's the divine wrath through the natural, or what's unnatural, but natural death. What will happen when we truly have this kind of clashing, lo nochin, slander, that the sages themselves don't create the kind of community that they're hoping for, that their list of sins for everyone, that they should really live out exemplary lives as much as possible, and yet be able to what? Disagree with civility, as you suggested, that we need this type of collection of minds and hearts in one place to do that work. And the story on 23 that I'll refer to here, that I included at the end here, is from our Masechta on page 23. It's the famous story about the Honi HaMagel. You've heard this story before, right? He's planting the carob tree, and they say, what are you planting a carob tree for? He said, well, didn't they plant it for me 2 generations ago? And he falls into a deep sleep. I'm telling you outside here. And he falls into a deep sleep. The end of the story was not often told, but here's the beautiful end of the story. And 70 years later, he wakes up, and there's the tree. And they say, who are you? And he says, who are you? And it happens to be that he's now with the son of his son. And it turns out that his own child is no longer there, but his grandson is. And they don't believe him for a second. And yet he can say every halacha as 2 generations ago they learned the halacha, and he's this source of great, a well of tradition. But there's no place for him in the world. Because why? He has no chevruta. There's not another sage with whom he can go through the learning again. There's a new generation that disregards the old tradition. And not only does he have to leave because he finds no chevruta, but they can't accept this older generation, which is a critique of not accepting the older generation. And it says, below chevruta, mituta. Without fellowship, death. The tree fortunately remained. Nature will still be there, I think, is one of the points of the story. But we, who are part of that great nature, have much to do to refine ourselves, to accept tradition, to see each other in civil discourse, refining wisdom for the world, and creating morality even against our nature. We want no storms. And for sure we want to pray for each other and the mercy that we deserve, and each person deserves because of his or her being part and parcel of this world. The son, the sister, the brother, right? The family unit deserves the Shekhinah, the indwelling presence of God, after these pieces of Gemara. And the voices that helped us achieve the wisdom in this case were the Gemara, the editor, Rabbi Yochanan's sister, the boy himself who knows from Torah that foolishness prevails, and anger can even get the best of you. If you won't accept the fact that even the next generation knows some Torah. But then also, I'm respecting you by letting you ask the questions, Rabbi Yochanan. But the culture could turn into very deadly, using Torah as a weapon.
It's very schwach for to understand. I don't know why. Rabbi Yochanan, he knows to argue. He knows to, and he stood in front of many students, raising a lot of questions. So one issue, I cannot believe that starts the whole story. I think there was some background to that.
I would say, of course, there's more. But we have the moments, like a filmmaker, how a filmmaker has an hour and 34 minutes in this case. You know, you've got to pick your scenes wisely. The scenes in this Gemara, the scenes in that Gemara, are scenes from a much richer reality, yeah.
Rabbi Yochanan also presumes to give away his sister as a prize.
To the guy that he killed.
Well, that's why I like the interpretation that he says, Reish Lakish, you're just the type of person whom my sister could fall in love with if you'll make tshuva and you'll come to the Beit Midrash. Like that. I happen to think there's a sweetness about that. it's kind of like a brother looking out for his sister.
Even prettier than me.
Yeah,
I mean, he put a lot of emphasis on it being
yeah, prettier.
Yeah, that's ancient language. I'm being very generous. I understand. I understand. I don't want to see him giving away his sister.
I'm being generous about the pursuing. Now that we reread things, that sounds homoerotic to me.
It might. I mean, if in a queer read of Talmud, right?
Well,
then
there are
midrash out there today.
And I haven't
that.
Come across it before, but this sounds like you should know the difference between a man and a woman when they're bathing in the river.
Well, but if he was androgynous,
I don't know.
Yeah.
He's bathing. You know the difference between a man and a woman.
Well, again, the positive read of it is that there's a connectivity in through the love, what will become the love of Torah, and probably great chemistry between these two who jumped in a lake together, right? So there is a certain kind of, you kind of hang with a chevre, and within spaces of men learning Torah, Boyarin talks about this in his scholarship, that there's a lot of homoeroticism sometimes within the context of pages of Gemara. For instance, just before on that page of Bava Metzia, to outdo what we're talking about now, there's a discussion about the size of male members.
We didn't read that yet.
Yeah, no. Exactly. So you can find a lot of interesting Gemaras about carnality.
I always say that a lot of time on
carnality and sexuality. If you were to look, Boyarin's book on that subject is called Carnal Israel. And it is...
I knew it had to be now.
And it is... he's at Berkeley. So you can just see, like, from which school this is coming in terms of this scholarship. But to bring it back...
Things shouldn't be ignored. I mean, there are things...
That's why we can be intellectually honest and say there are those who enjoy exploring that level of the Gemara's suggestions. I think it's a lot about their reading, retrojecting their readings, but they would argue that it's kind of really in the fabric from the get-go. That said, to end with a little bit though of where we started, by way of the storm in the Beit Midrash, or the storm brewing vis-a-vis rabbinic culture and the self-critical awareness and analyses they make, I really feel like it's almost like holding a mirror up to themselves. Sometimes the pages of Gemara are holding a mirror for the sages themselves who were creating this culture. And you know, I have deep respect for that self-awareness that comes through when we read the pages that way. That's where I think this one really lies.
Thank you.
Oh, very interesting.